This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN Refugee Agency reports a record-breaking number of deaths among refugees and migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea, making 2016 the deadliest year ever.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, French officials today continued efforts to empty the migrant camp in the port of Calais, known as the Jungle. 15 people are dead from three separate attacks in Kenya and Somalia. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the UN Refugee Agency reports a record-breaking number of deaths among refugees and migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea, making 2016 the deadliest year ever. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
There are still 2 months to go before the end of the year, yet the UN Refugee Agency reports deaths on the Mediterranean Sea have nearly exceeded the death toll for all of 2015. The agency reports at least 3,740 lives have been lost this year, just 31 short of last year's total. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says this is the highest number ever recorded in the Mediterranean.
If you consider that last year there was 1 million people crossing the Mediterranean and the number of deaths is about the same as this year, when three times less people have crossed, then you could say that the death rate has increased threefold.
The UNHCR reports 1 in 88 people crossing the Mediterranean Sea in 2016 is likely to die, compared to 1 death for every 269 arrivals last year. It says the death rate is even higher on the central Mediterranean route between Libya and Italy, where 1 death is recorded for every 47 arrivals. Spindler says the route from North Africa to Italy is longer and more perilous than that between Turkey and Greece. He tells VOA more refugees and migrants are losing their lives because smugglers are changing their business practices.
They seem to be sending large numbers of embarkations as opposed to one by one. Smuggling has become a big business. It's been done almost on an industrial scale. So now they send several boats at the same time. And that puts rescue services in difficulty because they need to rescue several thousand people on several hundred boats.
Spindler says the dangers also are greater because smugglers increasingly are using lower quality vessels. He says people are set adrift in flimsy inflatable rafts that often do not last the journey. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. French officials today continued efforts to empty the migrant camp in the port of Calais, known as the Jungle. There are up to 8,000 migrants there, many from Africa and Afghanistan. Yesterday, 2,300 people were sent to so-called welcome centers in towns throughout the country where they will be resettled. Reporter Lisa Bryant is following the situation from Paris. VOA's William Eagle asked her if France has allowed through its threat to use bulldozers to raise the camp.
Yes, France said that they would start demolishing the camp, which is called the Jungle here, starting today. That has been postponed, although the authorities say that will be happening later this afternoon, mostly because they're trying to sort of cordon off, just mostly security reasons. But reporters on the ground say that they have been seeing, you know, the bulldozers going into place. This is an old promise. You know, the authorities, this has been a long time coming, demolishing Calais. But it might be a sort of a tricky situation right now, because it seems like a lot of the migrants do want to leave, but there are some people who don't, and quite a few of them, in fact. And so it will be a question of how to get them out of the camp, because the government says that all departures will be voluntary.
So there are those who have threatened to remain, and if they do remain, what is France's backup plan?
That's the unclear part, because if you're assuming that the departures will be voluntary, it's unclear what the government is going to be doing about those who plan on remaining. It's possible they're just going to be scattered elsewhere in Calais. This is a long-standing problem for the region. This isn't the first time that the town has had these migrant camps. It's happened periodically. So that's the big unknown right now.
Some of the children or unaccompanied minors were allowed to go to the UK. Can you tell us a bit about that? I suppose they already had family in the UK.
Yeah, that's the case with, I would say, probably most of the children who went. Something like maybe 200 have already gone to the UK, and the government says that they are going to be interviewing other children with the idea that perhaps several hundred more may be leaving in the coming weeks. That's the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, who said that. But there are going to be different criteria, as you pointed out, that will be including whether they have family in the UK, also their age, and probably a number of other criteria regarding their background, where they're coming from, whether they're really fleeing a situation that is really an insecure situation, and where their family is. So there are going to be a lot of issues. But then there are also children who are still in Calais, and rights groups are extremely worried about what's going to happen to them, and that also might delay the demolition of the camp.
Of those migrants that have been sent to welcome centers across France, do they have a choice of where in France they'd prefer to settle? And I'm wondering, are any of these migrants being sent to parts of France where there's strong anti-immigrant or pro-National Front sentiment?
Yes, they're given two choices of places to go. So they can choose, let's say, one place or another. And then they're sent off. Many of the migrants who were boarding the buses said they didn't quite know where they were going yesterday. A lot of them went to places, let's say, in Normandy, you know, northern France. But they're going to be going pretty much most areas of France, including areas where the anti-immigration sentiment can be high. There have been demonstrations leading up to this whole operation by people who are pro and against what is being happening. But then there have been really good stories about, you know, small towns saying we want these migrants. In a very small village in France, there was one city hall that just said, listen, we're going to take them in, and if we don't get reelected, then too bad. We did the right thing.
That was reporter Lisa Bryant in Paris, France. She spoke with VOA's William Eagle. In related news, AFP reports about 25 migrants are missing after a vessel identified as a Libyan Coast Guard speedboat attacked a dinghy jammed with migrants. The attack came as the German vessel Sea-Watch and a tanker were on their way to rescue the migrants. Witnesses say the speedboat attacked the dinghy north of the port of Sabratha and tried to steal the outboard engine. Some of the men on the speedboat boarded the dinghy and beat the migrants with sticks. That caused the dinghy to nearly capsize and throw many migrants into the Mediterranean. The German vessel rescued 120 people and recovered four bodies, but up to 25 people are still missing. The European Union is considering an agreement with the Libyan Coast Guard to help curtail the number of migrants coming to Europe, but some criticize the proposal, saying migrants will be taken back to Libya, where they will be abused. A new report from the rights group Amnesty International accuses the UN mission in South Sudan of failing to protect civilians last July as they were being raped, tortured, and killed by government soldiers. Amnesty says it happened during fighting in the capital, Juba. It also says some peacekeepers fled their positions under fire, leaving civilians exposed. As Ayen Bior reports, one rape survivor told Amnesty International that UN peacekeepers and security personnel ignored her cries for help as government soldiers raped her in their presence.
A fundamental international humanitarian law is that all parties of a conflict must differentiate between combatants and civilians should never be targeted. Joanne Mariner, a London-based senior crisis response advisor for Amnesty International, says South Sudanese government soldiers repeatedly broke those laws during the fighting that erupted in July, and she says the violations continued for weeks afterward.
Government soldiers violated both international humanitarian law, which is the law of war, and international human rights law. they carried out really a brutal attack, deliberately killing civilians, raping women and girls, and carried out massive looting in the wake of the clashes in July. So it was really a host of laws that were broken by South Sudanese government soldiers.
In a new 32-page report called We Did Not Believe We Could Survive, Amnesty International says government soldiers assume that civilian support is aligned with their ethnic identity. So government soldiers gang-raped, killed, and looted civilians, largely based on ethnic identities.
And many women told us that the rapists made comments about their husbands being the enemy, about them, their families being the enemy, about their children being the enemy. So, you know, there really is a strong ethnic motivation and a sense that all Nuer are rebels.
The report says at least 50 civilians were killed between July 10th and July 12th at two Protection of Civilians sites at the UN base in Jebel, a neighborhood in Juba. Two Chinese peacekeepers were also killed after an explosive device struck their armored vehicle on July 10th. Amnesty International says the UN's inability to carry out their mandate to protect civilians made matters worse for hundreds of civilians. One woman told Amnesty International that she ran toward a UN base to escape being raped by government soldiers. She says she saw UN peacekeepers in private security and ran toward them, but government soldiers tripped her. And despite her cries for help, which she said could be heard by UN peacekeepers, no one came to her rescue. In another case on July 12th, after the ceasefire was declared, civilians say uniformed men, who they believe to be UN police, asked them to go back to the Protection of Civilians site as the violence seemed to simmer down. But the civilians refused and insisted on staying inside the UN base, which offered more protection than the POC site. They also said that violence could break out at any moment. When the civilians refused to return to the POC site, Amnesty International says UN personnel allegedly shot tear gas into the crowd.
Without really even giving them much warning, just suddenly spraying tear gas on a very frightened crowd of mostly women and children. We have testimonies from a number of families that some of the children fell unconscious, that elderly people were extremely, badly affected by the use of tear gas. So, you know, we're very concerned that this was a disproportionate and excessive use of force against a very vulnerable civilian population. And absolutely an inappropriate action from the United Nations.
The UN mission in South Sudan cannot be immediately reached for comment. Mariner says since July, there has been some progress in the UN's response to keep civilians safe.
There has been improvement lately in that there are more UN patrols where they're going out with armored vehicles and sometimes foot patrols and helping women get to market safely. But there's still, I think the response still could use some improvement. And in particular, the UN is barred by the government from going through checkpoints using armored vehicles. And so they're not able to accompany women all the way to the market. And this really needs to be remedied and changed so that women can be protected when they go to the market and bring back food to their families.
The UN Security Council approved a 4,000-strong regional protection force in August, in addition to the peacekeepers already serving in South Sudan, to act as a buffer between government and opposition forces. Despite repeated calls from the international community, that force has still not entered the country. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
15 people have been killed in three separate attacks in Kenya and Somalia. Al-Shabaab militants have claimed responsibility for all of the attacks. 12 Nairobi students died when Al-Shabaab fighters attacked at a guest house during a pre-dawn raid today in Bisharo on the Kenya border. Gunmen ran from room to room shooting the students. The victims were members of a touring group of actors. Also, Reuters reports that late yesterday, a Somali intelligence official, Colonel Abdiasis Araha, was killed by gunmen as he entered a mosque in Mogadishu. And last night, another attack occurred in Somalia when a suicide bomber detonated a truckload of explosives at an AU peacekeeper's base in Beledweyne. Two Djibouti peacekeepers were killed and four others were injured. Scientists in Zimbabwe say they have developed new heat and drought-tolerant varieties of maize that will be ready for sale ahead of the next planting season. The new seeds from the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center were developed to combat drought-induced food insecurity that has affected millions in southern Africa over the past year. Sebastian Mofu visited the research station in Shiredzi, Zimbabwe, and reports.
The International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, better known by its Spanish acronym CIMMYT, says the new varieties could play a significant role in reducing the problem of food insecurity in Zimbabwe and other parts of Africa. Cosmos Magorokosho is a senior scientist with CIMMYT, responsible for coming up with climate-resilient maize strains.
I'll call them a game changer because farmers will be able to get some kind of food security if they adopt these varieties. Food security in Africa will be partly addressed through these varieties because in Africa, maize is life. A lot of seed companies in many countries in Southern Africa, East Africa, North Africa, they've shown a keen interest in adopting these hybrids because they know that they will be working in their environments.
He said farmers in Algeria, South Africa, Egypt, Uganda, Malawi, Tanzania, and South Africa, along with Zimbabwe, have shown interest in the new maize varieties CIMMYT developed with funding from the U.S. Agency for International Development. Early this year, Zimbabwe declared a national disaster after about a third of its 13 million people struggled with food shortages caused by El Nino-induced drought. The CIMMYT official said the effects of that drought could have been mitigated had the heat and drought-tolerant maize varieties been on the commercial market. Apollonia Maruchaka from Zaka District, one of the driest regions in Zimbabwe, planted one of the new seeds from CIMMYT last season. There is real hunger here this year. I'm just lucky that I replanted the demo seed after the first crop failed. Compared to other commercial seeds, the demo seed sustained the heat and dry conditions we experienced. Despite the heat and dryness, I got something and I only ran out of food around February. Marichaka's neighbor, 66-year-old Amon Makonese, also managed to harvest enough to look after his family after planting the new seeds.
It's a good seed because it's drought resistant. The only thing is that it's not in the market. We look for it and we don't get it when we want it. Yes, it should be put in the shops where we buy other seeds. We end up buying other varieties because we don't find this variety in the shops.
That is not good news, given that Zimbabwe's next growing season is expected to begin soon. Zimbabwe Super Seeds, one of the companies distributing the new variety, said it is working to meet farmers' demands. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
While Tunisia is considered the only Arab Spring success story, it is still facing political, security, and economic challenges. Consecutive Tunisian governments have realized that improving the economy requires security and stability. The U.S. has provided the young democracy with training and equipment to help counter terrorism. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi asked Tunisian ambassador to the U.S., Faisal Gouaya, if Tunisia is more secure and stable now after years of instability.
All the facts show that Tunisia now is more secure and more stable. It is the result of a strategy and a big work that was done by the successive governments. We equipped our army and our security forces. They are trained now to face all kind of terrorist activities and terrorist attacks. Now we improved our intelligence, and here I would like to commend and thank the United States for its tremendous help and assistance to Tunisia. And also we have a better control of our borders, because most of the attacks and most of the terrorists, they are coming from abroad. So it is important for our army to improve the control of our borders to prevent not only terrorism, but also trafficking, trafficking of all kinds. There is a link between trafficking and terrorism.
Did the improvement in security and stability produce more tourism activities in Tunisia?
Yes, we noticed that stability now is rewarding the tourist season. We noticed big arrivals, especially Russians, but also neighboring Algerians. There is a comeback of French, Italians, and Germans. We are working on our traditional markets, and they are all Europeans. Maybe it will take some time. We will have a comeback of the tourist influx to Tunisia.
Mr. Ambassador, Tunisia is still facing high youth unemployment and shortage of revenues to create more jobs. What's your government doing to overcome these challenges?
This is one of the priorities of the successive governments, but this government is putting a strategy to tackle this problem, actually. We have a young population. We are producing, you know, every year more than 70,000 graduates. How the economy can absorb all this number of graduates? And we have to add to these people who are graduated, university graduated, all the other categories of youth that are asking for jobs, or all categories. It is not an easy task for this government, but there is only one solution. The economy should come back to work, to create jobs, to create opportunities for these young people. Besides that, the government is also allocating funds to help young people, especially those who are university graduated, to create their own businesses for their self-employment, but also to employ other people. The government is announcing to create at least 50,000 jobs by giving small and macro financing to young entrepreneurs.
What is Tunisia looking for from the United States to help continue its success story?
We are asking for trade, not aid, from the United States. We need investment. We need cooperation. We need partnership. We need investments in all sectors. I receive on a daily basis many business people and many CEOs that are looking for opportunities in Tunisia. That's why telling Americans come to Tunisia, invest in Tunisia. Tunisia has been always an attractive investment site with the new law, investment law, giving a lot of opportunities. But also we are organizing by the end of the month of November a major investment conference in Tunis. And we are trying to attract as much business people as needed to look at the country firsthand, but also to learn about the opportunities that are offered. And we have a master plan for the next 5 years. It offers at least 100 mega projects, big projects, with a total of investments of more than $20 billion.
That was Faisal Gawey, a Tunisian ambassador to the U.S. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to The Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
November 8th, American citizens will exercise their right to vote and choose their next president. VOA is providing comprehensive coverage of this unique democratic process. Who is going to earn the trust of the American people to lead the nation for the next 4 years? Find out right here on VOA.